Cancer Research UK podcast. Welcome to the Cancer Research UK podcast with me, Dr. Kat Arney. This month, we discover the risks of sunbeds, find out how cancer drugs get approved for patients, and take a trip to the Chelsea Flower Show. Coming up later, we hear how sunbeds led to skin cancer for one woman.
I told him that, yes, I did use them. I'd used them for many, many years. And was he going to tell me that I had skin cancer? And yes, it was skin cancer.
But first, here's the news with Julie Sharp.
Cancer Research UK scientists at the University of Dundee have uncovered the biological explanation for the use of arsenic as a treatment for certain types of leukaemia. The poisonous chemical has been used to successfully treat a particular type of acute leukaemia for many years, but until now it wasn't known why it worked. Professor Ronald Hay and his team found that arsenic helps to stick molecular tags, called sumo proteins, onto the faulty proteins in the cancer cells that cause the disease. An enzyme, RNF4, then hunts down sumo and destroys the faulty proteins. Lead researcher Mike Tatham explains more about what this research might mean for people with this type of cancer in the future.
Obviously, most people have heard of arsenic as a poison, and that's for good reasons, because it's very toxic. So it's quite surprising to find that arsenic can also be used as a treatment for cancer. If you're treating people with a poison, you've obviously got a risk of having toxic side effects for extended periods of time or for higher levels. So ideally, because we now know the sequence of events from treatment with arsenic to degradation of the cancer-causing proteins in the cell, we can look more specifically at the proteins involved, in this case RNF4, and say, well, let's see if we can design a drug that specifically deals with RNF4 or specifically inhibits a particular point in the pathway. So instead of having to treat patients with a poison like arsenic, we can maybe have a different drug that specifically acts at a more focused point in the pathway, which won't have the side effects that arsenic has.
And finally, Cancer Research UK-funded scientists at the Institute of Cancer Research have pinpointed part of our genetic code containing genes that may put smokers at even more risk of developing lung cancer. The team scanned the DNA of thousands of men and women from the UK and the US. All of the people involved in the study were current or former smokers, and around half were lung cancer patients, while the other half were healthy. The researchers think that smokers with certain versions of these gene regions may increase their risk by up to 80%, although we don't yet know if these gene variations affect people who've never smoked. That's all the news for now. Back to you, Kat.
Thanks, Julie. And if you want to find out more about these stories or get the latest from the charity scientists and researchers around the world, then have a look at our news and resources website. Summer's on its way, and many Brits will be looking forward to the bronzing season, thinking about topping up their tans with a trip to the local sunbed salon. Thanks to our annual SunSmart campaign, many people now know about the risks of excessive sun exposure and burning outside, but many are still unaware of the serious health risks posed by sunbeds inside. Overexposure to ultraviolet rays in the tanning salon could prove as dangerous as getting burnt on the beach, and in fact, using a sunbed once a month or more can increase your risk of skin cancer by more than half. I asked SunSmart manager Rebecca Russell just why sunbeds are so dangerous.
Well, we know that there are no health benefits from using sunbeds, but there are a number of health risks. So the main one and the most serious one is an increase in skin cancer risk. We know from a recent report by the International Agency for Research into Cancer that not only does that risk increase significantly from using sunbeds, but if you use a sunbed at a young age, that increase is up to 75%, which is a staggering increase.
People maybe have the perception that sunbeds are in some way safer than going outside in the sun, or that they can build up a tan that protects you. What do you say to that?
Well, unfortunately, some of the marketing tactics of the industry do reinforce that misconception, that myth, that a sunbed is safer than suntanning. However, that is incorrect. The UV rays from a sunbed are the same as the UV rays from the sun, but they can be actually equal, if not greater, intensity. We know that the ultraviolet rays from a sunbed have been shown to be 10 to 15 times stronger or more intense than that of the midday summer sun.
But some people say that, you know, having a tan from a sunbed, it makes them look sexy. What do you think about that?
Well, there is a perception, I guess, that a tan is desirable. But a tan, whether you get it from the sun or whether you get it from a sunbed, is actually causing permanent damage, irreversible damage, and accelerating the signs of ageing. So people will experience premature ageing, so wrinkles, leathery skin, etc.
So how is sunbed use controlled in the UK at the moment?
Well, currently there is no legal framework, so the industry is essentially unregulated. Cancer Research UK are calling on the government to introduce a piece of legislation such as a licensing scheme. Now, ideally, the components of that licensing scheme would prevent under-18s from accessing sunbeds. It would also mandate the provision of health information to all customers and make sure that sunbed use is supervised by trained staff that are trained to advise on skin type and to turn away people that are unsuitable.
And of course, it's not just sunbeds we should be concerned about. How can we protect ourselves from the risks of the sun this summer generally?
Sure. Well, we all need to enjoy the sun safely. We need to make sure that we cover up, that we avoid sunburn and spend some time in the shade when the sun's at its strongest, so around the middle of the day.
And have a good summer.
Absolutely. Enjoy.
Justine Shields from Liverpool used to be a sunbed fan, but she's now been treated for skin cancer. I asked her to share her story.
I was initially diagnosed in 2006, but I'd had a spot on my chest for 18 months previous to that that I used to just, because I'm a keen runner, I thought it was just all part of me running. And because it was in between my two breasts, I thought it was caused by the friction of my running bra. Went to Thailand for a month, came home from Thailand and noticed that it started to go a bit black and a little bit ugh, and still left it for another couple of weeks. And then one day went to pick a prescription up at the doctor's and saw a cancer research sign up in the doctor's about skin cancer. Walked out and walked back in and asked the doctors if they for an appointment. Went back the next day and the GP didn't actually tell me there and then that it was skin cancer, but told me that she needed to refer me on. And then that was, say, on the Tuesday, and on the following Monday I went to Ormskirk Hospital to see a dermatologist who asked me how often I'd use sunbeds. And I told him that, yes, I did use them. I'd used them for many, many years. And was he going to tell me that I had skin cancer? And yes, it was. It was skin cancer. So I finally, by the December in 2006, was free. Told me everything was okay. I'd be just on 3 monthly and then 6 monthly checkups. And I found a lesion in my head in the February, and it was just like a little wart. Went to the doctors, had it removed, and it came back as cancer. Because it was a lot deeper than they initially suspected, I needed to have my stomach cut open and 3 layers of muscle taken from my stomach to be built up into my scalp.
So you think that your cancer was down to your use of sunbeds. How often were you using sunbeds when you were younger?
Well, it started when I was 15. I could go so far as to say that I could maybe have gone on every day. I'd say up until my mid-20s. And then as you get older, you become a little bit more aware of the lines that are coming up on your face and your eyes and things like that. So you might maybe just go on it once a week. But I've used sunbeds up until I was diagnosed with skin cancer. I probably used sunbeds at least once a week.
And what would you say now to anyone who's listening, who's thinking, oh, you know, I like the look of a tan, I want to go on a sunbed, what's wrong with it?
I never ever thought it had happened to me. I never ever thought I'd get skin cancer, but I did. And I always like to look nice with a tan until I've been poorly and I look at myself now and I look younger without a tan. And even a suntan from the sun gives you damage, but damage from the sunbeds is even worse. And, you know, the younger you are using them, the more at risk you're putting yourself.
You can find out more about how to take care of your skin and stay sun smart this summer at www.sunsmart.org.uk. Now it's time for the final part in our series on drug development. Here's Anna Lacey to investigate the final step in the process, how drugs actually get to cancer patients and the hurdles they have to pass along the way.
Although cancer drugs start their development in laboratories, there comes a time when they need to be made on a larger scale. This is usually done by pharmaceutical companies. But before they take on a new drug and invest large amounts of money, they have to be fairly confident that it'll work. To make the decision easier, Cancer Research UK set up a company called Cancer Research Technology, or CRT. And to find out what they do, I went to speak to Hamish Ryder, the Director of Drug Discovery.
Industry in general tends to be fairly reticent to work on highly novel targets. So our role really is to take things on which might be seen by industry as too early stage and too risky, and to move them forward faster.
So what happens with your relationship with the pharmaceutical companies then? How do you bridge that gap?
Well, we'll take projects from academia, both from Cancer Research UK and from a number of other cancer research organisations worldwide, and we'll look for the best way of moving them forward. Now, it could be that the best way of moving them forward is to suggest further experiments they could do to add value to the project, or we may feel that there's the need to add value ourselves to the project. In that case, what we would do is we would bring the project in-house, demonstrate activity in cancer models, and then, having thereby de-risked the target, seek to find a commercial partner.
So by spotting promising drugs and performing the necessary experiments, CRT can introduce exciting new drugs to the pharmaceutical companies. But this isn't a one-way relationship.
The way it works is that Cancer Research UK owns CRT. CRT receives income from products which industry has taken from CRT and commercialised. This money is used, first of all, to run CRT, but then any profit that CRT makes is gift-aided back to CRUK so that it can be reinvested in basic research into cancer.
So you, as Cancer Research Technology, are not only forming a bridge between academia and the pharmaceutical companies, but you're also helping to channel money back to where it all started, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the main ideas behind CRT.
Once a drug has been through all the stages of development and made it through clinical trials, it has to be licensed. This is a seal of approval that lets doctors and patients know that a drug is safe to use. But to access a new cancer drug on the NHS, it has to be approved by another organisation, the National Institute of Health and Clinical Excellence, or NICE. Andrew Dillon is the chief executive.
What we want to do is to find out just how well a drug performs in terms of the benefits it gives to patients compared to what we have at the moment. So what we need to do is to look at all the clinical studies that have been performed to assess just how good is it compared to what we've got, and is it worth what the NHS is being asked to pay for it.
There are more drugs approved for cancer than there are for many other diseases. But with limited NHS money, it's inevitable that some cancer drugs won't make the list, even if they improve quality of life.
We know there's a difference between living with cancer and living with a chronic disease, which ultimately isn't going to prove life-threatening. What we try to do, though, is to remember that people with chronic conditions that aren't life-threatening are just as deserving of the support of the National Health Service and the care it can give as people who are living with conditions that are life-threatening. We think that the measurements that we use and the judgments that we make about the importance of improving quality of life are appropriate for treatments that are introduced for cancer and for the other treatments for other diseases and conditions that we're looking at.
And in making all of those decisions, are there any ways that NICE as an organisation can try and speed up that process so that good new drugs do get to the patients more quickly?
One of the key things that we can improve on is the point at which we actually start work. New drugs get introduced, but there's a long development time in advance of that, so there's lots of opportunity for us to put a flag on those new treatments coming through that we ought to be looking at. And we can make sure that we can get advice out to the NHS within a few months of a drug being licensed.
As the drug reaches the patient, so we conclude our story of drug development. We started by looking at the molecular sites of cancer and then discovered chemicals that stop it from forming. These chemicals were then trialled in test tubes and animal models before being given to people in clinical trials. If a drug is safe and effective, then it's given a licence, and with the approval of NICE, the drug can be given to patients through the NHS. The journey from lab to patient is very long, but each step is crucial, because together they lead us towards better treatments for cancer.
And finally, every year Cancer Research UK has a themed garden at the Chelsea Flower Show, generously paid for by an anonymous benefactor at no cost to the charity. Last year, our garden won a gold medal, and we've got high hopes this year. I spoke to garden designer Andy Sturgeon about this year's entry.
Well, the whole concept of the garden is progress, and this is really something which has come out of all the work that Cancer Research UK does, and I wanted the garden to represent this. Really, the style of the garden is perhaps best described as a contemporary woodland garden. Planting-wise, the dominant features really are seven trees called Southern Beech, Nothofagus, which is from Chile. And this is starting to create the mood of a woodland, but to really create that atmosphere, I've got 27 tree ferns. And they're really going to give the woodland garden this sort of contemporary feel.
And how are you managing to represent progress within the garden?
Well, progress is mainly represented by these pools of water that we have in the garden. So there are four pools, and they start small at the back of the garden, just 2.5 metres wide, and they get progressively larger towards the front of the garden. And also within these pools, we have these ripples of water. They're computer-generated from underneath, but they're meant to look as though raindrops landing on the water, and you can imagine when these concentric ripples spread out through the pool and progress outwards. And each one of these ripples, there are three or four or five in each of these pools, and they're going to be in a sequence. So they'll dance backwards and forwards through the pools, but there'll be a general trend forwards. So in other words, this idea of progress from the back of the garden to the front.
So you've got pretty high hopes for this year then?
Well, you have to aim high at Chelsea, or there's no point turning up, really. So you have to aim for a gold medal, whether you're going to get it or not. And, of course, you do it partly for yourself, because you've put a lot of pressure on yourself. But, of course, you do it for the sponsor as well, because it means a lot to them. They're investing a lot in this, and it's important to get the results. I think it's 6 years. This will be the sixth year Cancer Research UK have had a garden. And the track record has been pretty good, and so far I've had two golds for Cancer Research UK, so I'm aiming for my third, so the pressure's on.
Well, we've reached the end once more, so I do hope you've enjoyed this month's podcast. Don't forget, we'd love to hear your feedback, so send us your comments and suggestions by email to podcast@cancer.org.uk. We'll be back next month with all the latest news, including finding out how people with cancer can share their experiences, plus a quick jog around the park with thousands of women. Yes, it's Race for Lifetime again. So until then, goodbye.